Englandy. This is the moment the crowd have waited for. Just look at him go.
Congratulations, Catherine, on your wonderful performance in winning the gold medal in the 400 metre event of the Commonwealth Games.
Ian Thorpe really going for it. 3:40.17. This is absolutely amazing.
Tracy Wickham, a great world record here in Edmonton, and there it is, a world record.
The Diamonds Commonwealth drought has broken.
The hockey revolution has a golden uprising.
Adam Ayres, congratulations, and a games record. Adam Ayres has got a hat-trick of gold medals at the Commonwealth Games.
This is something to savour, something to remember for the rest of your life.
Get set, Australia. Welcome to Gold Coast Gold. Here's your host, Dave Colbert.
Hello and welcome to Gold Coast Gold. I'm David Colbert. This week we head inside 150 days to go to the Games. The Queen's Baton relay edges closer to Australia and the medal for the Games are unveiled. Teams will be announced shortly, and trials for team and individual sports aren't too far away. After a break last week to speak with Games boss Peter Beattie, we go back to the Legend Series, and this week it's one of the best we've ever had, the Superfish himself, Kieran Perkins. But before we speak with Kieran, and as we count down with just 22 Fridays to go to the Gold Coast Games, let's take a look at the headlines from another big week in Commonwealth Games news. Start with swimming and the big guns of the pool hit the water in Adelaide for the Australian Short Course Championships. Glasgow Games gold medalist Kate Campbell returned to the pool with a bang, clocking a new short course world record in the 100 metre freestyle. The 25-year-old from Brisbane, who chose not to swim at this year's FINA World Championships, took 0.33 seconds off the previous short course world mark set by Sweden's superfish Sarah Sjöström in August. Campbell returned to break the Commonwealth record in the 50-metre freestyle. Meanwhile, fellow Glasgow gold medalist Emily Seabom eclipsed Matt Welsh's record as Australia's most successful Australian short course swimmer, winning her 26th national title. The 25-year-old Triple Olympian, five-time world champion, won four golds in Adelaide, the 100 and 200 backstroke and the 100 and 200 individual medley events. Also, Olympic 100-metre champion Kyle Chalmers had a successful return to the pool, taking the 100-metre freestyle title. Meanwhile, Seabom and Emma McKeon were the big winners at Swimming Australia's Gala Awards dinner in Adelaide. Seabom was awarded the Olympic Program Swimmer of the Year, whilst McKeon took home the Swimmer's Swimmer of the Year award. The Paralympic Program Swimmer of the Year award went to Brisbane's Commonwealth Games gold medalist and Rio Paralympic freestyle star Rowan Crowthers. In netball, Australia fielded a young team with limited Diamonds experience but still came away with third place in the Fast Five netball series in Melbourne. It wasn't usual rival New Zealand who took the crown, rather England, who prevailed over Jamaica in the series playoff. New Zealand went down to Australia in the bronze medal match. And Netball Australia has named a 14-strong Diamonds squad that will travel to London and Johannesburg in January 2018 to contest the Netball Quad Series. Paige Hadley and Shani Layton returned to the Diamonds team after both missing the recent Constellation Cup. Although this is the final tour prior to the Commonwealth Games, the door is still open for all squad members to put their best foot forward for a position in the Commonwealth Games team of 12, Coach Lisa Alexander said. The Netball Quad Series is the final test series for the Diamonds before the 2018 Gold Coast Commonwealth Games. In athletics, South Africa's Olympic gold medalist in the 400 metres is out of the Commonwealth Games after suffering a serious knee injury in a celebrity touch rugby match. Wade van Niekerk, the 400 metre world champion and world record holder, suffered a medial and lateral tears of the meniscus as well as a torn anterior cruciate ligament and will be out of action for at least 6 months. Meanwhile, Games organisers have agreed to make changes to the road walks course for the Games. One section of the course had included an uneven left-to-right road camber, while the bends at either end of the 1 kilometre loop were judged too sharp for the fast pace of the Games walkers. In rugby sevens, Australia's women's sevens team have taken out the Gold Coast sevens, beating Canada 27-12. Emerging duo Emma Sykes and Dominique Dutoit please coach Tim Walsh the most, with Sykes being named tournament MVP. The win came after Australia defeated Fiji in the quarterfinal and the New Zealand development side in the semis. And the Australian men's team ensured that they came away with a winning double, taking the win against Fiji and Barbarians 19-17 in the final. It's the Aussies' second win in as many tournaments after coming out on top in the Invitational Oktoberfest Sevens in Munich. Meanwhile, the Queen's Baton is on the home stretch. The Queen's Baton Relay has entered Oceania, the final region in its global voyage around the Commonwealth. Over the next 7.5 weeks, the Baton will explore 13 Commonwealth nations and territories of Oceania. Landing in the tiny island of Nauru, it'll travel to Kiribati, Niue, Cook Islands and Tonga before arriving in Fiji on the 20th of November. And finally, sad news. The Commonwealth Games family mourns the passing of boxing pioneer Tony Madigan. He was one of just 5 Australians to win an Olympic boxing medal and the most successful boxer in Commonwealth Games history, with 2 golds and a silver medal. His boxing career included 2 fights against a young Muhammad Ali. And on that sad note, that's this week's Commonwealth Games news. Our Legend Series on Gold Coast Gold continues, and this week our special guest is the Superfish, one of the all-time greats, Kieran Perkins. 4 games, gold medals across 3 games, and some stunning performances in the middle of all of that, including being a flag bearer for the Australian team in Kuala Lumpur in 1998. That and a whole lot more. It's a great pleasure to welcome Kieran Perkins. Great to chat to you.
Thanks, Dave. It's nice to be here.
When you think about Commonwealth Games, you think back, what does it evoke in the big brain of Kieran Perkins?
Oh, look, I think the thing that always hits me about the Commonwealth Games is that, you know, you've got that multi-sport event, you know, it's a like the Olympics, in that you've got so many countries, so many athletes competing in so many different sports all coming together, and it creates this carnival atmosphere that is just, it's unlike anything else you do. But the Comm Games is more fun. It's just a little bit more relaxed. It's a little bit more human and personal than the big machine that the Olympics tends to be, and because of that, you know, most of my memories of the Comm Games sort of relate more to fun or the team stuff and how we were, as opposed to these kind of intense moments where it's just about this a race and the rest of it kind of fades away, which is really nice.
Was it like that for your first games as a teenager back in 1990, because that was where you first came onto the scene?
Absolutely. I mean, 1990 was incredible. It was in New Zealand, of course, in Auckland, and while, you know, that's not home, it's close enough. And there were so many Aussies there, and it was really probably the last time I was on an Australian team where, you know, that team environment revolved around a bit of a pecking order. You had your senior members, you had your young members. There was a lot of larrikinism and a lot more, I don't know, just it was a bit more loose, if you could put it that way. And it was really quite extraordinary, because I'd not been in that environment before, and there was all these people that I'd looked up to that were legends of the sport, and you came into this team environment. And we had a massive long camp at the AIS in Canberra before we actually went over to Auckland. And the stuff that we just did as a group in that real, you know, classic kind of hijinks, bonding, coming together was just fantastic. And that environment was really, I probably, out of all of the teams that I was a part of, in terms of the most fun and that you know, that sense of care, that was the team that I remember the most out of that, because it was just amazing how we all worked together. And you know, rookies' nights were out of control, and, you know, we went out and ate meals and did all this stuff that, you know, as it all got a lot more professional and serious, seemed to move away.
You wouldn't get away with some of that stuff now. And I was on that team in 1990. I was a member of the famous Animal House, which was totally overblown, but I understand exactly what you're talking about. Was a function of that relaxed atmosphere the fact that
you know, you're a young athlete on the rise. You go to the next games, and we'll get into the performances, you know, later, but just generally speaking, you go to the next games and you're the Olympic champion. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, it's a different Kieran Perkins that's standing on the starting blocks.
Yeah, look, absolutely. I do think that does have a big impact. You know, you go to your very first one, you're young, you're unheralded, but sort of someone that people are looking out for. But you're on a team with Hayley Lewis and Lindley Frame and Lisa Curry and, you know, all these other names that just absorb the spotlight. And so it definitely contributes to that sense of wonder, I suppose, because you've got more time and space to just kind of enjoy it as opposed to being really tightly caught up. And by the time 94 came around, I mean, you know, there was much greater expectation from a performance perspective. But I've got to say, you know, you still come away from those games and that environment with, you know, just with a lot more memories of the fun you had together as a group as opposed to it all just being the serious sporting stuff.
Let's backtrack a bit and get, you know, to the young Kieran and how you became a swimmer in the first place.
Look, like most kids that sort of, you know, came around in the 70s, we did everything. My parents weren't ever particularly, you know, sporting or strong that, you know, we had to follow a certain path. It was just more of everyone was just participated, we were involved. So I did it all, running, athletics, gymnastics, tennis, cricket, AFL for whatever reason, soccer. The list goes on. And the one thing that was consistent in all of my sporting experiences was that I was really bad at them. I have no coordination at all. My hand-eye is hopeless. I can't run. You know, you just think of all those traditional sports like that, and it was never a particularly joyous experience on the performance front for me. And fortunately, my primary school, Indooroopilly State Primary, had a swimming pool and a club. And on a Friday, anyone could go and have a swim and be a part of that environment. And, you know, I just really enjoyed the opportunity to go and compete in a space where, you know, you were accountable 100% for your performance, and you could see very easily whether you'd done better or worse. You know, if you'd improved, it's on the scoreboard, you know you've done it, and if you hadn't, you could do your soul searching and understand why. And that was kind of the trajectory. You know, I just found this environment where I just loved that sense of wanting to improve and to achieve and being able to actually see it, which really led me on.
It escalates very quickly because you're 16 when you went to Auckland. So, you know, that period of time between being a 10-year-old and a 16-year-old happens in the blink of an eye. Was the progression that quick? You know, did you go to the first state titles, dive in and give everyone a complete flogging and think, hang on, I'm pretty good at this?
Yeah, no, look, and that's the thing, you know, my swimming experience probably, I was never one that people looked at and went, wow, he's talented. I was the plotter who just sort of never gave up. And,
I don't believe that. That can't be possibly true.
No, well, and look, so the where it does become true is you think about the stuff you did as a kid, and it's all sprints, right? You do across the pool, and then you go to 25 metres and 50 metres, and like I didn't swim my first 400, I think, until I was about 13. And, you know, I wasn't a sprinter, so I wasn't successful in doing those sprints, and it wasn't until, so at 13 I swam my first state 400. I don't think I medaled, but I qualified on a time perspective to go to the age group nationals, which were in Tasmania, the Glen Orchy Pool. Remember it well because it was bloody cold and I got sick. And that was my first one. And I managed to make the final in the under 13 400, came eighth. And that was kind of the first real entree into higher level swimming, but it was in the distance events. And then, you know, the next year I swam my first 1500, and it really was, you know, I would say when I swam that first 1500 as a 13 turning 14 year old, that was when the trigger hit, and it was like, oh, hang on a minute, actually, you know, maybe there's an opportunity here. And, you know, to be then, what, 18 months, 2 years later, competing at the Commonwealth Games trials, that was a whirlwind. It really was. You know, I went from, you know, just swimming because I loved it and being a reasonable club grade athlete to on the Australian team before I even thought that I could be.
That's Darwin theories of a theory of sport. Not everyone starts off as a sprinter, no matter what sport you're in. It's freestyle, 50 metres, 100 metres, and then you end up as a marathon runner or a 1500 metre runner.
And then all the sprinters will tell you that the only reason that I was successful is because all the smart guys stopped and I was the only one still going.
At that age, as a 13 and 14 year old, were you across the romance of the 1500 metres? Because, you know, growing up for me, that was the event. You know, I wasn't across Murray Rose and John Conrad's, but certainly Stephen Holland and his attempts to try and win the Olympic Games, the 1500 metres was the bomb. That was the one.
Yeah, look, and it's a funny thing, you know, when you compare doing it versus spectating, right? Like, if you got the choice between being a good two-lap swimmer or a 30-lap swimmer, you're going to take the two laps, right? But the reality is absolutely, you know, like I grew up listening to stories of Murray Rose and John Conrad's and the heroics of the 1500. Steve Holland was obviously big, but to be honest, the athlete that I probably actually watched and connected with was Tracy Wickham. You know, she was obviously massive through the mid early 80s there, and winning gold medals and breaking world records, and you know, the 800 for women was our equivalent. So, you know, I think when I first started competing, certainly at an Australian Open Championships level, when I look back on it and you think about it, like there was Jason Plummer and Michael McKenzie were the two guys. Still remember their names, and they were lauded, and because they were our 1500 metre swimmers. And relatively speaking, they weren't successful like a Steve Holland or Rose, Conrad's, Wickham, etc. But because they did the 1500, they, you know, they were sort of positioned as these amazing athletes in this incredible event. So it was it wasn't something that I set out to do, but there's no doubt as your career progresses, especially you realise, and that custodianship of you know, the romanticism that Australia has about the event, I mean, that really hits you when you get older and you sort of come out the other side of your career and you think, wow, I mean, like, those names that people that I talked about in revered tones, to think that you may have any kind of place within that register is just nuts, and it's certainly quite an honour.
And then, so you not only got the names, but you've got the time, like the 4-minute mile, the 15-minute barrier. It's still a barrier. Someone swims under 15 minutes in the 1500 now, you go, well, that's good, no matter what level, and it's an achievement. And, you know, you did that in Auckland. As a 16-year-old, broke 15 minutes. Did you pinch yourself? You mentioned Michael McKenzie. He won that 1500 metres in Auckland, I think.
Glenn Houseman.
So there's another name. And then, of course, you've got Dan Kowalski and Hackett, who we'll talk about in a second. But that 15-minute barrier.
It's huge. Look, and you're right. It is a big thing. And I guess, you know, it's really quite interesting when you think about the progression of your career and the competitors you had, right? Because Glenn Houseman he won in Auckland. And it's actually entirely his fault that I swam that fast in that race, because at the trials in Adelaide, Glenn broke 15 minutes in the heat. And before I watched Glenn swim that race, because he was in the heat after me, before I saw that, I didn't believe 15 minutes was possible. You know, both Plummer and McKenzie never broke it. They got close. They were 15:01, 2:03. You know, they were on the cusp all of the time. And there was this kind of global view at that point, because Salnikov was the only guy that had done it, that, you know, it was unworldly, it was unusual, it was just, you know, it was nigh on impossible. And so before I watched Glenn swim that race, I didn't believe 15 minutes for the 1500 was achievable. You see a guy, you know, from Rockhampton in Queensland, who you've watched in training, you've been, you know, around on the pool deck, you stand and watch him do the impossible, and you come away from that, and it just completely changes your concept and your mindset of what can happen. And the thing is, at the age nationals, which I think were like in April or something, in 89, I swam 15 minutes 41 or 2, which was a massive best time. Went to the Com Game trials, and which, I don't know, would have been September, October maybe, and went 15:21, and came away from that having seen Glenn break 15 minutes, and all of a sudden I'm thinking, well, that's what I want to do, and, you know, I'm going to try and achieve that. 3 months later, you get to the Commonwealth Games in Auckland, and you do it. And you know, I often talk about it. You know, even if I was arrogant enough to think that I was the most professional trainer that ever existed in the universe of swimming, you don't drop that kind of time just because you've physically improved. You know, it was this whole belief in what was possible that I think contributed to that next jump. And that was entirely Glenn's fault. I'm sure he doesn't know it, but it was just mind-blowing.
You talk to Deke about the marathon. He says you get to 35K, all you want to do is sit down on the side of the road. And I'll just share a little anecdote. Before the 92 Olympics, my brother wanted to know how painful it was to swim a 1500. So on the day of your final, he went to his local pool and swam 1500 metres and tried to do it, not a swimmer, but he said he was laying down on the ground for about an hour and a half afterwards, unable to move. And I don't know how long it took him. Probably an hour plus. How painful was it for you as the master of that event to suffer through it? How much suffering was involved?
The funny thing about it is that some races, you know, you'd feel your chest start to tighten after 100 metres.
That's a setback.
That is a setback. They were never good ones. And there's other races.
Olympic heats in Atlanta, maybe, one of those.
Yes, that could be one I'm thinking of. And, of course, other races, you got to the end of it and you didn't feel a thing, you know. So I always say that, I don't think the marathon is comparable. That's you know, 2 hours of racing, no matter what type of racing you're doing. I think swimming a 1500 metres freestyle is probably not unlike doing some of the big rowing events, or you know, maybe the 10K on a track. But it really, if you're honest about it, the places that you hurt yourself the most is in training. I mean, the work you do to get to the point where you're fit enough and strong enough to be able to do a 1500 metre race, I mean, that's where you really, really knock yourself around. And, I mean, I remember, you know, you'd go through periods in training where you'd come home at night and you couldn't sleep, even though you were completely exhausted because your shoulders are so sore that you can't find a comfortable position to lay without them just throbbing. And the masochist in you goes, yeah, I'm doing a great job here, you know, I'm really, really, really working hard. Whereas after a race, you know, it's a different kind of breakdown, because there was periods of time in some races, and I remember actually the 94 Commonwealth Games being one of those where I actually couldn't eat for a couple of days afterwards. You know, just the physiology of it really knocked me around, but I wasn't sore or, you know, like muscular skeletal kind of knocked around. I was in the pool training the next morning, but you know, the physiological impacts can be different.
My next question was going to be about your coach, but I'll get back to that because I want to touch on that 94 games, given that you mentioned it, the four gold medals there. And you won the two and the four, but the famous race is the 1500, where, you know, everyone in that team, everyone in Australia is watching, and you set a world record in the 800 on the way, and you look up and see the scoreboard, and then you put your head down and, you know, move on to win that gold medal. Were you at the peak of your powers then? You'd already been the Olympic champion in 92 and silver in the 400 there and got that Olympic gold, but was 94 the peak for you?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's interesting when you see the progression, because the thing about 94 that was very, very unique was that we had the World Championships in Rome 2 weeks later. So you're kind of preparing for the Commonwealth Games, which as an Australian and as a member of the teams is the second most important thing you'll do after the Olympics. But then as a swimmer, as an individual, the World Championships is the bigger one. So trying to manage to do both and how you get through that. And at the Comm Games, the 200 was a complete surprise. Didn't expect to win it. Did it because I qualified and, you know, it was just, that was mind-blowing. The 400, you know, I did want to win that one, so that was kind of good affirmation. And then we had the 4x200 relay in there somewhere along the mix as well. But by the time the 1500 came around, because we knew we had the World Championship so soon after, and you know, my coach, Mr. Crew, had strategically also recognised that the Worlds was going to be the tougher race from a time perspective. That's where we were aiming to peak. It was in Rome. And so, you know, before that 1500 in Canada, Mr. Crew, you know, we had a plan to do the 800, swim it hard, break the world record, because I'd just missed it at the Pan Pacs the year before. And then ease off and you know, obviously win the race, but don't kill yourself here, because you know, you can recover very quickly from an 800, but the 1500 just adds that little bit of extra, you know, physical effort that means that to recover from it, to get up and race again is that much harder. And so, you know, I touched the wall, saw the all in the 800, got to the 800 metre mark, saw the world record, thought, wow, that's fantastic, I've done it. And I thought that I was just rolling along after that, but of course, you know, the training that you do, you train to go hard to the end. You've got a bit of adrenaline because you're excited about it. It's all happening, and I touched the wall and saw that I'd broken the 1500 record as well. And it's mad, you know. But there's this moment of sheer elation that you'd done this incredible thing, and then this sheer horror that Mr. Crew's going to kill me. Oh my God, what have I done? You know. And literally, when I got out of the pool, I was walking. They had this temporary stand on the other on one side of the pool, and I was walking through the tunnel under it to get to the other end to where the warm down area was, and I could see Mr. Crew at the complete other end of it, standing there waiting for me, just, you know, fuming. And Don Talbot's kind of come running up the outside of the pool to break to get into one of the middle rows to get in between us. And he's literally kind of intervened and go, oh, it's wonderful, congratulations, oh, it's exciting. And Mr. Cruz looked at me, he's going, yeah, no, that was a good swim, But, you know, what the bloody hell were you doing? I told, you know, and laid into me about not doing this tactic. And you know what? He was right, because I went to Rome and swam the 400 there, and that is the best performance in terms of getting ultimate potential out of myself that I ever did. And of course, by the time the 1500 came around in Rome, I was sick because the you know, just being worn down. So, who knows how much faster I might have gone? But there you go. I'm certainly not complaining about it, because it's incredible to contemplate that, you know, in sort of that 3 week period, I won what, 4 Commonwealth gold, broke 3 world records and 2 world championships as well, and it was amazing.
Just tell us about Mr. Carew, because I love how you swimmers call your coach Mr. Mr. this, Mr. that. All, no matter when you see them, you know, when you're retired, they're still Mr. There's always a bond, and as close a bond as an athlete coach in any sport, I reckon.
Look, and it's incredibly important, because you just think about the practical mechanics of it, right? Like, I was 9 when I first went to the Carew Swim School. Started, you know, going to squad there because I enjoyed it. And at 9, everybody's, well, back in the olden days anyway, everyone's Mr. or Mrs. And, you know, once you start training full-time, you're at the pool at 5-something in the morning. You're with that coach and that squad till, you know, 8:30, when you then rush to school. You come back in the afternoon. You're back at the pool at 3:30, and you're training through till 6:30 again with that coach and that squad. You know, you go home. You might see your family for an hour or two before you do your homework and go to bed, and do it all over again. And for that period of my life where I was, you know, swimming and at school, you know, the largest adult influence in my life by far was Mr. Crew. I saw him 6 hours a day, every day, in the pool, dealing into that environment where you're really challenging yourself to find, you know, exceptional performance every minute of every day, where you're being held accountable to what you're doing because of this goal that you ultimately share to get to, you know, that kind of environment. And it's an amazing relationship, and it's an incredible bond. And if it isn't built on mutual respect and trust and all of those things, it won't work, or it certainly won't work as well as it could. But when that stuff's there, you know, it's amazing what you, you know, what you experience and what you can achieve together.
We're with Kieran Perkins, the Superfish, 4 Commonwealth Games gold medals, flag bearer in Kuala Lumpur, which we'll talk about in a moment. What did you learn from Mr. Carew during your swimming career that you still, you know, touch on, draw from every day now in life?
Oh, look, I mean, there's a million things, right? You know, you could break it down into all sorts of different stuff that, you know, about performance, effort, whatever you'd like to call it. But probably the thing that I hold the most in all of it is that, you know, he was very, very strong on making us all recognise that, you know, being an Olympian and being a Commonwealth Games gold medalist, being a famous swimmer is great, but you're still a human being, and as a human being, you're accountable to the universe of who you are. And you know, because of that, the morality, the standards of behaviour, the things that he used to hold us to in all of that, with varying degrees of success depending on the individual, of course. You know, it's just always stuck with me. And there's a saying he used to say, which this is a G-rated podcast. I apologise now, Dave, but he always used to say to me and to others in the squad that, you know, it's a really short ride from the penthouse to the shithouse. And, you know, it's so true. Everyone you see on the way up, you're going to see them again on the way back down. And all of us will end up going back down. And if you aren't, and you have to live with that. And you have to live with the impact of that as you go through. And if you don't recognise that, then, you know, you may not necessarily, when you're old and on your deathbed, reflecting on who you are as a person in life, you may not be as proud as you should be.
We could talk about, you know, events and obviously 96 Olympic Games, gold medals, one of the great iconic moments in Australian sport, but this is a Commonwealth Games podcast. So I'll just jump to 98 where you're the flag bearer for the team, yeah. Where does that sit? It's totally different accolade from winning a gold medal as an individual or being in your swim team as one of the leaders, but being the captain of the Australian team at an event like that.
And look, you're absolutely right. It's a totally different accolade. You know, all the stuff you do in the pool, you do because you control it, you're determined, you work hard, all that stuff. And then one day someone says to you, completely out of the blue, we'd like you to carry the flag and lead the Australian team out into the stadium for an event like that. It's just, I mean, it's humbling. It's truly extraordinary because no matter how successful you become. And it doesn't always show, I suppose, because you want to be cool and part of the team. But, you know, it doesn't matter how successful you are. You stand up in front of that group and there are many people in that group who you are in awe of and you admire because they are gold medalists, champions, legends. And to see yourself at that moment kind of, you know, representing that and them and all that have gone before and all those that are going to go in the future is... It's shocking. And you know, look, honestly, that night was a complete blur because it was just so overwhelming for me. I never anticipated that would happen. I never thought in my life that I would receive that kind of an honour. And, you know, I'll never forget that while I don't remember many of the specifics because it was all a blur, it's probably the proudest I've been as a team member by far.
And a good recovery too, because in 94 they wanted to send you home for firing off an air pistol in the... we can't get away from a Commonwealth Games podcast with Kieran Perkins without talking about that. But rather than the incident, I just want Arthur Tunstall.
Yeah.
How did you get on with him?
Look, pretty good, to be honest. I mean, you know, it's really quite... it's extraordinary what happens in these circumstances, right? And you're right. We don't need to relive the incident too much, other than to say,
was it true?
Well, while I retained commercial ownership of the implement at hand, I wasn't actually the one that I didn't even get to use the bloody thing. That was. Because I was training, you know, 1,500 metres from her. That's real good. But anyway, the thing about it, I guess, was that you're right. Arthur had a hard line, wanted us to go. Don had a hard line and wanted wanted me gone. He said, you know, it's unacceptable. It can't happen. And, you know, I probably went into that thinking that, you know, I needed to take responsibility for the chain of events I'd set off and therefore I'd accept whatever I had to. And Arthur, you know, for all his...
idiosyncrasies?
Good word, thank you. For all his idiosyncrasies, you know, he was one of those people that, you know, when push came to shove and the chips were down, he always went into bat for the athletes. You know, it didn't matter what the circumstance was ultimately or whether you did or didn't really agree with Arthur, you know, he was just one of those people that, you know, he come hell or high water was going to do what was best for the athlete and the team and I don't think that always came through, you know, because he was a bombastic human being and, you know, when you're dealing with someone like a Don Talbot I wasn't privy, obviously, to all the discussions went on, but, I wouldn't want him in the room when those two stood off because, you know, Don Don never took a backward step in his life, and Arthur was a boxer. So, you know, man, oh man, that would have been very interesting for a few moments there. But yeah, look, I think Arthur was one of those guys, and you know, I'd probably put him in the same frame of reference as a John Coates. You know, you may not necessarily agree with ultimately all of the viewpoints and the stands that they take on things, but you can't disassociate yourself from the fact that there are innumerable athletes who achieved incredible things on the world stage because, you know, guys like Arthur gave them the opportunity to.
Two more questions for Kieran Perkins, our king of the pool. Home games advice. A lot of the listeners to Gold Coast Gold are athletes that are in this team. They're not in it yet. They're preparing for it, etc. You've signed off on your career at a home games in Sydney. You understand what it's like to have that pressure of the home games. What advice do you have to the athletes that are preparing for it today and, you know, in the coming weeks and months in the lead-up to the games?
Look, I think the thing that you have to recognise is that it is bigger, harder, and better in everything that you could imagine. Like, there's just this escalation of everything that's involved. You know, you'll be more nervous, more excited. You'll have more attention. I mean, the whole thing, there's just more and more and more and more because it matters more. It's at home. You got your friends, your family. They're all there. They're all watching. They're all in close quarters. And the thing that probably stood out for me the most in Sydney was just how much actually you can't escape it generally, because, you know, for me, and we didn't have social media, so, and I will move on that as well. You know, for me back in the day, we could actually go into the village, and then once you were in the village, you were free. No one could get to you. No one could bother you. You didn't have to read the papers if you didn't want to. You didn't have to talk to anyone on the phone. You were absolutely closeted in an environment where you were protected 100%. And then you get to Sydney and at a home games, and you know, the person cleaning your room is an Aussie and they know who you are. The person opening the door at the food hall is an Aussie and they know who you are. The person, all of a sudden, everyone that's there knows you and they're supportive and they're excited and so this need to escape is harder to fulfil in that environment. So, you know, I guess my advice to all athletes is that, you know, recognise that that's going to come at you. Recognise that everybody is doing it because they actually love you and they're proud of you and they want to see you succeed. Now, there isn't a single person that you will interact with that doesn't actually have joyous feelings of hope for you. And you need to take it that way, and you need to allow that to be the frame of reference that you're coming from. But if you do need time and space, make sure you find very early on when you get to the village somewhere that you can go that will give you that, whether it's your room or the headquarters or whatever the case may be. And the social media side of it is a really important thing to recognise as well, because, you know, I have a general view that, you know, being on social media as an athlete during the games, it's not a great idea, because you're exposing yourself to a whole bunch of opinions that are uninformed and have no deep knowledge or care for what will or won't impact you. And so you have to be really careful about how you interact with and what you will and won't absorb in that environment and in the way that it's going to test your resilience. And the same thing is true of all those people who are interacting with you on social media. You know, I over the years have seen probably some of the most damaging commentary come from family who have nothing but great care, you know. But because of their words of, we know you'll win, or it'll be easy for you because we know you're a champion. I mean, that comes from a place of love and excitement. But there's a lot of athletes who hear that and it kills them because, oh my God, what if I don't win? What's family going to think of me if I don't win? So, you know, I just ask everyone to recognise the impact they can have and just take care to be supportive in the right way, and just know that all of our athletes are going to love it and they're going to have an opportunity to do something that most athletes in their careers won't ever get to do, and that's compete at a home Commonwealth Games. And We all have great hope and wishes for you because we know that you'll do your best.
I've taken up enough of your time, but I've got one further question, which is the transition to life post swimming. You've been pretty good. Everyone has their own ups and downs. There's been some celebrated crashes in a lot of sports. Swimming's, you know, near the top of the list when it comes to you look at, you know, what's happened with Grant and the likes over the years. You've made a very successful transition, successful career in banking. How have you managed that, and what did you do in that transition between that home games and the last one where you're hanging on to get to the finish line and then moving into the post-swimming life?
Look, it is infinitely difficult, and while it might publicly look like it, I've done it well or easy, I assure you it wasn't. And the thing that I actually have to go to when I talk about this is it doesn't start when you retire. It really should start when you first decide to become an athlete, because you know, it doesn't actually matter how successful you are, it doesn't matter how much sponsorship you get or gold medals you win, there are very, very, very few successful athletes who don't have to get a real job and have a real life after they finish. You know, yeah, sure, there's going to be a few that'll make their fortune and they won't ever have to work again, but you know, you're talking about the 0.0001% of the 0.001% of the that get to these heights. And so, you know, being able to actually recognise that, you know, there will be life after, and that life after is going to require you to assimilate into the real universe. You know, I think really is a responsibility that all athletes, but all of the people supporting those athletes need to take on board when they start their careers. And it comes back a little bit to the things I talked about that Mr. Crewe used to push with us. You know, if you're a whole person, if you're a whole human being as an athlete, A, you'll be a better athlete, but B, you'll be able to cope with life after sport much better. Because if 100% of your life, 100% of the time is sport and nothing else, what chance do you have when you've got sport, when you don't have sport anymore? You know, you need to have those outside interests. You need to have that vocation, that education, that passion, that whatever that gives you that whole human being and that whole personality. Because when sport does go away, no matter how whole you are as a human outside of sport, when sport does go away, your life irrevocably changes, because you really do go into an environment where, you know, every day of your previous career, you have woken up and you know where you're going, how you're going to get there, why you're going to get there, who's supporting you to do it, and comfortable and safe in the knowledge that all of that means that you've got great purpose and direction in your life. When all that's gone and you don't have that purpose and direction anymore, and those people aren't there all of the time because they're still doing what they're doing and you're trying to find your new space, it's really bloody hard, and you need to be able to recognise that you are going from one area to another, and it's a hard road. And you know, one of the things I often say to people, just because you're a world champion or the greatest swimmer that's ever lived, if you woke up one morning and you decided that you were going to become a hockey player, what would you do? And how would you go through that process? And how hard would it be to become a competent hockey player, let alone the best in the world? And why do you think that life after sport exempts you from recognising what that is?
It's good advice. I said that was my last question. I've got one more. Home Commonwealth Games, your home Commonwealth Games, it's in Queensland. It's on the Gold Coast, but it's Queensland's Games, and the chairman, Peter Beattie, says it's going to put Queensland on the map, and it's the coming out parade and all of those things, just like 1982 was for Brisbane. How much are you looking forward to it?
Oh, it's going to be spectacular. I mean, there is no doubt that the Commonwealth Games is the fun event. It's on the Gold Coast, so you're in Party Central to begin with. I mean, I know we're all going to trade off on the beautiful one day, perfect the next. The weather will be brilliant. Like, it's all going to work beautifully. But when you, and you know, selfish swimmer, right? You sit and you look at the venue, the pool, on the Broadwater spit there. You know, like the views over the water back towards SeaWorld, and I mean, it's just, man, how it's iconic. It's stunning. It's incredible. And not only that, we're going to have a whole bunch of Aussie athletes doing great things. So I'm excited by it. I think everybody that's going to be near it or have the chance to go to it, you won't help but be absorbed in this thing, which is just incredible. Not only that, it's going to be held in one of the most beautiful places in the world. So happy days. It's going to be great.
I think so. Kieran, thanks for your time. Really enjoyed the discussion on Gold Coast Gold and a Commonwealth Games legend, and it's great to chat to you.
I appreciate it. I'm happy to.
That's it for this edition of Gold Coast Gold. A reminder, you can subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an edition. You can join us at Commonwealth Games Australia on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram to keep up with all the news regarding the Australian team. 2018 Gold Coast Commonwealth Games. Until next week, thanks for your company on Gold Coast Gold.